Okay, so I would just like, in my capacity as a research symposium get-it-together person, to welcome you all, and especially to thank Amici for being here tonight to do a presentation on all her research into abuse and trauma. And I, for one, am happy to be here. Even on a Sunday night, I thought, oh, symposium time. Oh, it's Amici. So thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
And welcome to those, I think maybe, have you been here before? A couple of times. Stephanie, is that your name? And there are three people on the phone. Hi, Suzette. Hi, Phyllis. And hi, Tamara.
Hi. Hi.
Can you hear us all very well? Can you hear me right now?
I can hear you well.
Okay, great. And if I could just ask you a couple of things, those of you who are in the audience. If you would like to ask a question or make a comment, could you please, please, please try and remember to use the microphone, because otherwise the people on the phone won't be able to hear you. It seems like they can, but they absolutely can't. And if you could hold it close to your mouth, that also helps them be able to hear and feel really part of the whole thing. So unless it's a complete trauma for you, please do try. Hi. And yeah. Yeah, that just saves the batteries. And everybody on the phone, you're very much with us, and it'd be great if you join in and ask questions. You're really clear. If you have any comments, just let us know. Cough, say Yahoo, here I am. And I guess Amici will be telling us what you want in terms of questions or when and where and stuff. So,
okay.
Also, we usually ask for a donation for this evening. If you'd like to, at the end, put a little donation on that table there, that would be wonderful. That usually goes to something to do with research, to do with the Process Work Center. And unless Amici has a very specific purpose for it, in which case do let us know. Are you ready to go?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Have you got your thing turned on?
Yes.
Okay. And we will be recording this, so it will be available as an audio file on the web probably tomorrow or the next day if you want to listen for a second helping. So thanks a lot for being here.
Thank you, Lee, and thank you all for coming out on this true, probably first real day of spring. I really appreciate you being here, and hello to you folks out there on the audio line.
Hello.
Hi. It's really nice that you're with us, and we will do our best to be mindful that we need to use the microphones.
Thank you.
And I also want to say hello to the future listeners. That was Will, just he's a four-legged friend making a sound. And I want to use that to illustrate a little something, because a part of me has been spooked by knowing that somebody will hear this talk possibly in the future. And it's had, what it's done is it tweaked a part of me that has one of the symptoms that Judith Herman in her book Trauma and Recovery talks about as constituting a post-traumatic stress disorder, and that is the whole thing about hyperarousal, in that there's a part of me that is still wired for self-protection, and in my terms, looking to keep the sovereignty of my being intact. And so I've got, over the weeks preparing for this, I got really scared about somebody I don't know could be hearing me in the future. And then I thought, as a process worker, you're using the future as a third party to inhibit you now. And I've just sat with that. And various different things have happened. And then going nearly into that spook, I got down to a place where I remembered this poster we used to have in the incest and child sexual abuse recovery center that I had the great privilege of being part of creating and working in for over a decade. It was a quote from Catherine Mansfield, a New Zealand writer who I adore, and it said something like, "Be afraid, yes, be really, really afraid, and do it anyway." And then I thought, okay, because it's not all of me that's spooked, but as with abuse and trauma, with any of us, you can get tweaked in the present time because there's a part that gets frozen around what happens, and then there's a part that carries on. And a lot of the work is unfreezing that part that's gotten frozen and helping it to have a storyline, a narrative. Because often the part that gets frozen affects the part of the brain that doesn't have, is unconscious. It's the, if I can say this word right, the amygdala. I'll write that on the board. I don't know if I'm even saying it right, but I'll spell it. A-M-Y, oh boy.
G?
G, that's right, A-M-Y-G, amygdala. How do you folks say it over here?
I think it's amygdala.
Amygdala, all right, that works for me. Amygdala, amygdala. it's that very primitive part of the brain that gets formed in the first couple of years that is, you have the emotional experience, but you don't have a cognitive narrative on top of that. And that's why a lot of people who have post-traumatic stress disorder and any kind of flashback are not yet able to create a story about their experience, and that's one of the stages of recovery. I'm getting a bit ahead of myself, but I just wanted to say that it's to me it's a great privilege to be doing this, and it's very scary at the same time, but if I was going to be doing it anywhere, I'm glad I'm doing it here. And yet it's strange, you know, 30 years ago I was on television, on radio, and doing oodles and oodles of social action around particularly incest and child sexual abuse. But in those days I didn't have an inner life, and I didn't have access to a whole lot of feeling functions like fear that I have now. And I learn a lot from my fear, because it's a doorway to a state of vulnerability that I was too armored to even experience. And in that way, the upside of that is it helps me when I work with people where I see myself reflected in them. And many times it happens to be males, curious enough. But then that makes sense, because men have a very tight social conditioned role they're supposed to fit in. Women do too, but differently so, in terms of feelings, to be needy, to be vulnerable, to be afraid. Those kinds of things are usually more difficult to get access to. Okay. Before I talk about process work, I feel that I need to mention a couple of sources of information that I really highly recommend. One is Judith Herman's book, Trauma and Recovery. And it's really good for lots of reasons, but one main reason is that it lays out a three-stage phase of recovery. It's good for mapping out the territory of trauma. And the stage one is about establishing safety, and in that way, by making sure that your client in your office knows how to support themselves when they leave your office, in the sense of basic life support systems, food, money, a support person or people, and that they can count on themselves with some sense of predictability and basic health needs, and that self-destructive behaviors are at a minimum or kept to a minimum. You can't go on to the next stage of the recovery process in this model until you know that that person has a basic working sense of safety. And you might be challenged as a therapist to make sure that those things are in place, because two big problems happen. Sometimes the person races in to tell you all the details of the awful trauma that's happened to them, and then they can disintegrate. And then often that gets an issue. Why did you let me do that? As it, you know, the role that's not in the field for that person, the ghost role for them, you expect that you will be dreamed up to inhabit it. And so it's like if someone thinks that you should be taking care of them rather than them taking care of themselves, they're going to challenge you around that. That's one of the reasons why you need to be careful and go slow in this first place. And then the stage two is what she calls remembrance and mourning, which is about telling the story in full, in front of you, the witness. And without leaving out the awful parts, this can be edgy territory, and you need to invite the person and what happened, you know, like get them to tell you everything, because it's the reconstructing of the narrative can come only after it's out. And as you probably already know, most survivors, victim survivors, will not tell you everything in one go. It's often never been safe to. We'll give you a little bit, check how you deal with it, give you a little bit more. So you have to be proactive in coming forward and inviting them. A lot of mourning in this place, mourning for the loss of innocence, childhood, often decent parents, and all kinds of layers and layers and layers and layers of feeling. And in this case, issues of revenge, compensation, and justice. I'd like to talk a bit about those things at the end. If you have an abused person in front of you who wants revenge, work on it as a fantasy, but you can't afford to give them the idea that they're going to get revenge or justice or compensation in the larger society. They may not. There aren't any guarantees, and it's important to actually look for other ways to get it. At least other ways to make meaning of it. Because the court system is an adversity system, and it's about to disprove that woman or man or girl or boy, that to prove that they're wrong, that they're lying, that they're making it up. And I did a lot of court advocacy work. The person has to be really together to go through that, because it's actually a horrendous situation, and it can often be extremely re-traumatizing. I've had many clients who went really backwards after going to court, and we were naive in thinking that with the support we give the person, that they will be able to get through it. Some do and some don't. And that got to be a choice as part of the empowerment of the client. But, you know, being real about it. Yeah, the strongest person who goes to court because they're being raped there's no guarantee that he or she is going to be able to hold himself together through it. It's not a pretty scene. The same with justice. You know, you can't locate the source of justice too far outside of yourself. It means you can't look for someone to give you a sense of justice. In a way, I think the best justice you can have is to take your life back and to make it healthy and to make it happy. And if you connect getting compensation and justice to punishing the abuser, you might be waiting a few lifetimes. And you're still connected to that person and that energy. Okay, and the third stage that Judith Herman talks about is reconnection into the fabric of life around you and developing a sense, a new future and a rebuilding a sense of self. It's often compared to the process of immigration. You're starting again, in a way, and reconciling with yourself, particularly around thorny things like, say it was sexual abuse. If there was a part of you that physiologically responded, that many times women and girls have said to me, I feel so bad, you know, because I had an orgasm. And my response to that is, you have a well-functioning body. And your abuser knew how to use it. Because you had an orgasm doesn't mean anything more than you had a body that's working well. It's like constantly reframing those things in terms of ordinary reality. In this stage, there's lots and lots and lots of relationship work because it's about reconnecting with others. And what she calls finding a survivor mission, some sort of social action. Right. I really recommend that you read her. Part of me wants to leap into other things, but I'm just slowing down. She created the post-traumatic stress disorder and complex post-traumatic stress disorder. It's really helpful as a map of the territory to use, not to be to follow everything through it, because everyone has their own individual process and things will happen at different rates. Because, all right, I'm just going to follow what comes up instead of trying to be too linear. Because from my point of view, as a person who endured incest from being in the crib to age 13 and then gang rape at age 16 going on 17, there are parts of me that I still identify as being a victim. Keep breathing out there. And parts of me are a survivor. And then there are other parts of me that are a thriver. And I feel like it's a bit state-oriented just to say, oh, here's Luann. She's a victim of incest. She is, in that this thing happened to her, but we don't know what her inner experience of it is, and how it was now may not be how it is tomorrow or next week. You can say, oh, there's Luann, she's a survivor of incest. Yes, part of her is, but that shouldn't cut out the possibility of another time that she will feel victimized by something that tweaks her in her life. For example, not so long ago I went to the dentist and I had to have a cracked filling removed, and I've been in a long process with dentists of educating them about having my mouth held open, and we now have some non-verbal signals when I feel that I'm getting freaked, and this particular dentist will stop. But the injection and going home, I had more pain than you would have imagined, than more pain than you would expect for one injection. And something about this particular spot, I've had a lot of head trauma, gave me more pain than I thought I'd have. And so I felt victimized by that experience. And I was fortunate that day that I had the time to get a hot water bottle and a cup of tea and lie down and curl up and cry and then take care of myself and watch the clouds go by and eventually feel better. And so, you know, the good enough parent inside that constantly growing is taking care of the one who couldn't take care of herself. Then I want to add another part to this situation. For those on the phone, I've drawn three circles, and they are interconnected. You can imagine three circles. The middle one is linked arms with the two on the outside. Can you get that out there?
Yes.
Okay. And one is called the victim, and one is called the survivor, and the other is called what I'm calling the thriver. And, you know, there are areas where they cross over like this. And as a process worker, this is a continuum of experience. This is a continuum of human experience. Sometimes I am in a victim place. Sometimes I'm in a survivor place, and sometimes I'm in a thriver place. It's pretty obvious what a victim and a survivor is it? No. Okay, well, in different things it's going to mean different. A victim is someone who feels totally or absolutely downed by her experience. Something awful has been done to her or him, and they are in pain. There is no overview of the experience. A survivor is someone, and they're in the stage of building safety in the victim stage after the initial assault and trying to pull together the threads of sanity. And in a survivor stage, it's issues around knowing the parts that are wounded, what we call your edges, and where you get tweaked, what your strengths are and what your weaknesses are, and starting a business of recreating a possible future starting today. And a thriver, in my view, is someone who is fairly intimately familiar with all the roles in the field and has a capacity to interact with them. Particularly the most unappealing role, which, if we're talking about sexual abuse, will be the abuser or a bystander. And that's an ongoing dynamic that we need to cook with, because sometimes people will be out there in the world and be thriving and doing really, really well, and then something will happen that will throw them way back. So to have a kind of a state-oriented approach to a person who's a survivor, victim of trauma of any kind is to do them a little bit of a disservice. Right, I'm just checking my notes here. Yes, the survivors dealt with all that layering of issues that come up, like blame, self-hatred, and shame, and guilt. But you know where those things belong, and you've made some kind of sense with yourself, and the patterns formed from the abuse. You know what you're working with. For example, with me, that hyper-arousal thing that I talked about, I'm constantly vigilant about, for example, where the next exit is, and I even in my mid-50s, I cannot or will not sit with my back to a door for any long period of time. I just can't settle. Now, I can make that a pathology, or I can say it's a preference. I know which one is more fun to me, so I'm going there. And in the relationship channel, I kind of have a tendency to, before I get conscious, the energy of the more secondary energy of the abuser, which was very heavy and violent and very military, before I'm aware, I can get into a kind of take no prisoners attitude when I'm in a fight. And it's wonderful to be in a community where I'm reminded that if I'm having a fight with Sonia, that she will say to me, hey, remember I'm your friend. And so because something gets tweaked where, for me, it's kind of life and death, before I get my awareness working. And so it's a constant evolution. And I don't think that this is actually anything particularly unusual. It might be exacerbated because we've all got our perceptual holes that we learn from, but that's one of the ones in the relationship channel anyway. And here comes a question.
So you're describing you're describing the survivor aspect of those three roles in a sense.
When
you just describe that process that happens to you about hypervigilance and you know, protecting yourself in the door, are you imagining that in one of those roles?
I think it's in that space where the victim and the survivor interconnect like this, because many times I look around, I think, let's do a reality check. I'm not in any immediate danger here. This is not of the here and now. Okay, this is a red line back to then and there. It's not here and now. But without developing a meta position, I can't talk to myself like that. So that's one of the values of not staying constellated in just one experience. We'll get to that. Here comes another question.
I just wanted to support, or I heard you do all three when you were saying your experience. Maybe it's not your experience, but I saw you saying about I could pathologize myself because I would, where I was sitting, which would be more of a victim. And then the other, what you've already said, survivor, and then you said about the thriver, you said it's more fun to do this. So it seemed like you would move your fluidity of moving in between these parts and a meta position of mind. That seems present thing.
Thank you.
Can you repeat, Michi, or summarize? I couldn't hear.
Summarize what Robert said?
Mm-hmm.
He was giving me a really nice compliment. He said that the way I just talked about this example of what Judith Herman says, hyper arousal, which I call being sort of differently wired, that I was being moving between victim, survivor, and thriver.
Thanks.
Okay.
You didn't say this specifically, but I love that you have those overlapping circles and the little squiggles in the overlapping parts, because that really gives us a sense then of a fluidity between the roles, between the parts.
Did you hear that out there?
Hello? Out there?
So there's a heart around the three circles?
A heart. Well, that's nice. Yes.
Right.
It looks to me that they're not so much roles. They're more like ways of experiencing. No.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? Like they ways can, how you organize your information.
Mm-hmm. They can become roles if they get state bound, and they can become. I can be in that role, or any one of our clients could be in that role if we put them in that role, if we perceive them that way. And the way to shift doing that, because it happens really quickly, is to know them in yourself, to know where you're vulnerable to feeling victimized, and to know where you identify yourself as a survivor, and to know where in life you are thriving. One of the things about the thriver experience that is really important is being able to pick up the abuser role, or the least savory role in the field. What I mean by picking that role up is picking up its energy and using it positively. I think about my military father, and people get really scared about doing this, and there's good reasons for it, because society doesn't support that. You want to just take these people and put them in prison. People get scared of picking up the energy of the most unsavory role in the field. We want to put them behind bars. We want to put them where we can't see them. Now, if that actually helped, particularly with sexual abuse, maybe I'd be for it, but it doesn't. The role itself has to transform. And it's important to engage with that role, to engage with the energy of it, not especially the personality, but the role. All right, let's go there right now. We have such a wonderful thing in process work when it comes to roles and fields, because the value of the field phenomena is that it depersonalizes and recontextualizes your own personal holocaust. Because the role is bigger than the individual personality, even though what you experienced was intensely personal. And any personality is bigger than one role. I'm bigger than just a survivor, or simply a thriver, or just a victim. It's more complicated than that, as you are more complicated than that. And roles can be fixed in time and space if we do that, if we relate to them that way. And doing that, we really do marginalize the dreaming around these roles, and we only relate to one layer of the three-layered cake of reality: consensus reality, dreaming, dreamland, and sentience. It helps me to think. Let's talk about the abuser for a moment. All right, the scary bit. And initially, it's very scary. And one of the ways to minimize the scare of understanding the abuser role is to find the sentient essence of it. We have lots of fabulous ways to do it. You know, we can think of it also as the energy as a weather system. We can do the vector work. Anything. I would start there with people and work towards consensus reality. Just to do that on a sentient level is also to marginalize consensus reality. And as most people live in consensus reality more often than not, they have to be able to find their way there. Mm-hmm. Yes, we can't leave out the most unsavory role in the field. We know from information theory that it doesn't go away. In fact, it comes back even more intense. It's like a hungry ghost, and the way to feed it is by interacting with it, or an orphan It's looking to be adopted, to be related to, and to be learned from, and to have a place in the field, strangely enough. And the perpetrator or the abuser is a very socially downed role. And it's a question of timing when you bring in the secondary process of someone who's victimized in the background, what is there. Many of us, before we could do otherwise, picked up some of the energy, habits, ways of being of the abuser, particularly if the abuse is long term. And it was helpful to me in process work to get to the sentient essence of my incest abuser. And the sentient essence was, in fact, a hawk. And this very precise shoom, going for it, swarming down and precisely getting it, no matter what, overriding any feedback, just swarming down to get what it needed to feed. And so where do I need this in my life? I need it in the area of career. I'm very passive about putting my best foot forward in the world channel. And I need it around creativity. Now you might say, oh, it doesn't look like you're shy about putting your best foot forward. Look at you. You're sitting here talking about this stuff. And then I had this out with myself a while ago, and my answer to that is, what comes up is in it sort of an internalized sexist figure that says, oh sure, I can talk about abuse and incest and rape because that's sort of women's business. You know, that happens mostly to women. And you can talk about that stuff because it's emotional, and that's okay because you're a woman, right? And this is a real, I want to swear, it's a real little fucker of an energy. And it's like, it's an internalized sexism. It was like really sneaky. But it's there. And so what it did was it had this effect of making me feel sort of passive until something else kicked in. And one of the things, personal empowerment and connection are key dynamics in the recovery process. And so each time I feel really disconnected from myself or the rest of humanity, I know that I need some help, and I'll get it one way or another. And any time I feel a sense of internal downing, I have some work to do. Right. As you probably know, many sexual abusers were abused themselves, and I had 9 months of working with incest offenders way back there, and it was very gratifying to me to read in books that many of these folks were extremely weak in the relationship channel, which doesn't come as a surprise, and except bullying and power over. And that they were actually looking for human contact and love and a sense of their own power. And, you know, fairly primitive methods used to get those needs met. But if we honor our theory, then we can't measure the total person by their behaviors. We can challenge and teach them to change, even at first, and this is the only thing that worked back then. We have to use the fear of consequences to start this change process. All of those, and they were men, all of those men, the thing that got them real to stop the bullshit was the fear of going to jail and being raped by other men. In Australia, they call them rock spiders. child sexual abusers. That was the one thing, that was the consistent leverage that we worked with. Then you get more less dramatic forms of working with them, because underneath those behaviors, you have to ask yourself, what story is the perpetrator telling in his behavior? Talk a little bit about the victim role. Now, this is my own opinion here, and people may disagree with me, but I think it's okay in contemporary USA to be in this role, and probably contemporary Australia and many other places, in the victim role if you're a woman or you're a kid. Even then, it's a bit time limited. I think it's a different story for young men and male adults, because there's a basic misogyny in the background. It's female to be raped, terrified, and needy, and to show it. And it's basically uncool to be a victim. It's a kind of city shadow. And in the background, I think, with men, there's a real fear of being damaged like a woman, and a real fear of homosexuality underneath. And I think that is a sad reflection of rigid sex roles and where society is. That reminds me of another book that you turned me on to, Ken, Sandra Bloom's Sanctuary, Towards the Creation of Sane Societies. One of her main ideas is that we actually live in a society laced with post-traumatic. I think that's actually quite true. Get on to that a bit. And I say the victim is a bit of a city shadow. Well, so is the abuser, big time. And, you know, each of us need to learn from our own victimology. Almost all of us at some point have had an experience of abuse. It isn't out there. And so in terms of my victimology around sexual abuse was, this might seem strange to you, but a kind of state of grace from necessary surrender. If there's nothing that you can do, you can't get away, and you can't struggle. Well, you can, but it made it worse. But you have to give up. It's, in a way, it's a doorway to altered states, which you can learn to use well later. And my victimology has taught me to be alert to danger really quickly. And one of the upsides of that, and I have to say this, I'm probably speaking from a thrive state, is many, many years ago, I was about to get on a plane to leave England and go to Greece. And I had a very strong body feeling not to get on that plane. And on takeoff, it burst into flame and 86 people were burned to death. And it's like, often in the car with my partner Rhea, I have a wider margin of safety and alertness, and we've had many relationship scrapes because when she's driving, I'm like in my own sense of things, I'm a few steps ahead of her, or I'm like, you know, my margin of safety is larger than hers. And first of all, I would react with the energy that I inherited unconsciously from my abuser before I caught myself, and I would criticize her with quite a lot of affect. Because, you know, I was right and she was wrong. And dialing that back and really working with it, and where did this come from? And tracing it back, a good amount of my abuse happened while I was ostensibly having driving lessons a little later. I started having driving lessons when I was 11. So I had to find that. And now it's like catching what Arnie calls the little nano flirts, the little tiny little signals that alert me to some kind of distress. And I try to engage with it really quickly. And it's a big learning thing for me to say, I don't feel safe. Because I never expected anyone else to make it safe for me, or that I actually had the right to be safe. I only had to do it myself. So I'm very indebted to Raya for waking me up to that.
It's just this, the victim. It seems like a role that's been really controversial. You know, as far as nobody, there's something wrong with identifying or being too much of the victim. And it seems to me that, like what you just said, that there was a lot of fight. There was a long period of fighting just to be recognized as having been victims of abuse. In the culture, in the consensus reality world, people didn't want to acknowledge that this even existed, abuse of children, especially by fathers of their daughters. And so it was a huge battle that still goes on, even like the whole controversy in courts and regressive memories and things like this. So it seems like an important, I'm asking you, I guess also I'm making a statement that it seems like just to recognize that the driving lesson, that there was a victimization in that, it gives you a kind of context, and also does it give you, I guess I'm asking, does that give you a kind of a support or a context or a way of dealing with feelings that you might not otherwise would be hard to deal with? You know, like, is there a value, I guess I'm asking, in that, in the victim? Pardon? In the insight and in the, like, something really did happen to me in this situation, and I'm reacting from this, and that helps me to understand and deal with something. So the victim can be a really, it seems to me like a really crucial part of the healing.
Absolutely. I don't think you can ride roughshod over this. You can try to deny that you're victimized. But you know, as we know in process work, behavioral changes that aren't supported by a dreaming pattern in the background usually aren't sustainable. And I think one of the problems, Matt, looking back now, back to the 80s when I was part of this group working with child sexual abuse, is that we worked in a fairly tight feminist modality. And it was a zeitgeist of the time that you said you identified as a survivor, because it was in reaction to the patriarchal, like, down-pulling energy that you didn't accept being a victim. You were a survivor. And at the time, we didn't know any better. Everything's a total teleological learning process, but that's why I don't know how this three-stage dynamic of victim, survivor, thriver would have gone down then, because it politically the force was to identify as a survivor, and you were constantly in reaction, which is still to keep you in a sense caught in the same system, and the greatest freedom is to create your own. So thank you, Amit.
But also, I want to say that was part of the development of the whole theory, and that was social development to, like you said, like Robert said, to even recognize that there was a problem and to stand up for that. Mm-hmm. That was the beginning of that, really.
Right.
So in that sense, it was, you know, it was a momentary, situation, or I don't know, development.
Right. It's a parallel with combat vets, in a way. It's like, you know, way, way back around World War One, they started, was it World War Two, to think about shell shock. Now it's a recognized phenomena. And, you know, we say in process work that you can't have a personal problem over too long that isn't connected to a social problem. And I think we have a social problem around victimology, that you can be a victim for a short period of time, then get over it and move on. That's the way it was, just get on with it. As if an act of will is going to do that. It might do, but it's like working with addiction. You can try to will your way to not take substance X, but it won't hold. And so we have to actually get into that role, find out where we are in it and where we aren't in it, and see it as something that we inhabit, but we don't live in permanently. And don't let yourself be fixed in it permanently, or fix someone else in it permanently. Well, same with survivorship.
I just realized that, which I'm a little embarrassed about, these three, as Sonia said, ways to process information, victim, survivor, thriver, that really, and when you described the driving situation of being a victim and then reacting and then being a survivor, thriver, that they're all momentary states that occur and reoccur continuously.
Mm-hmm.
And having that fluidity is really a meta skill here.
Mm-hmm. And it's okay to be stuck at times too. That's right. Just human.
Right.
Oh, I want to suggest something about inhabiting difficult roles. You could start with your own childhood dream in terms of finding what the most marginalized part is in there, because that will usually show up as a ghost that's sort of knocking on your door trying to disturb you in some way. And getting to the essence of that ghost and using it in a way that doesn't irritate your conscious mind. Like, let's take a childhood memory of mine, which is I'm tucked up in bed, really tight, so tight like I can't move my arms, and I'm crying. And so we have the bed and the child in it crying. What's missing in this picture? The tucker-upper, or the loosening of the tuck, so to speak. Right? So if I pick up the tucker-upper, then I need to bind something or someone in some way, or some part of me. But I need to do that in a way that doesn't start a fight with my conscious mind. If I identify as someone who doesn't bind people up, which actually I don't, I'd have a bit of work to do. Or let's take the other side, because I think you have to pick up both the tucker-up and the loosener. The missing figure is the one who comes along and loosens the blanket so the little kid can move and breathe a bit more. Many times in my life I have been dreamed up to be a rescuer and a savior, and had quite a career as a social activist from that view. And that actually I developed into a pretty one-sided character. You're for us and you're against us. You're part of the problem, you're part of the solution, and nothing in the middle. And I've been in a long-term process of having a little bit more fluidity there to be able to be helpful without rescuing. And as a therapist, this is a really huge thing, particularly with people whose personal sovereignty has been messed with in one way or another. You can't rescue them from their fate. Don't do anything for them that they can't do for themselves. You know, it's counterproductive. You're actually part of the disempowering process. I'll give you an example. Once upon a time, I had a therapist who offered to call up my father and have it out with him. And on the surface of that, you'd think, wow, impressive. But actually, it wasn't close to my process. It wasn't what was good for me. And I was really confused in days for weeks and weeks until I worked out that actually, unconsciously, this therapist was sort of fostering my dependency on him. And then I realized that maybe he'd come to an edge about being just emotionally naked in the moment. And it would have been helpful to ask me, where are you at in your relationship with your abuser? What would be good for you now? Or something like that, probably put in better therapeutic terms. So it's really a question of timing. And all along this process, the client, the person has to be engaged in their own empowerment. You can't empower someone else. You know, you can empower a lawnmower, but you can't empower a person. You can invite them to take more and more opportunities to flex their emotional and psychological and social muscle, but you can't give that to them. In a way, it's something you become like an. Our role is to be an ally not in the castaneda sense of the word, but in the regular sense of the word. You're an ally in the process. With them, you are co-creating for them. Any questions so far?
I'm not sure if this fits in here, but you got me thinking when you started to talk about the childhood dream. Mm-hmm. And I thought most childhood dreams are actually very traumatic experiences. And Emma, just wondered if you had any thoughts about that, that that's sort of like almost like the basic abuse experience, or I don't know.
It's very common, that's for sure. I mean, what we do know is, this was a few years ago now, that 33% of girls are sexually abused and 16% of boys. But I don't know, I didn't know that most childhood dreams are very traumatic.
A lot of childhood dreams, nightmares.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's another gift that, in a way, that process work has in terms of child, not the traumatic childhood dream, but that we look at childhood dreams as a snapshot into the person's overall life myth and the inherent task built into that. So it's kind of like we each have a fate, and how do we respond to it? And we can, it's like in a way supporting a person to see it through the eyes of a victim, through the eyes of a survivor, and through the eyes of a thriver, like a teleological kind of continuum. I don't really know how to answer that question, Sonia, except that we work with what we're given.
It makes me think that when you said
as a therapist, finding those roles or states in yourself, that nightmare quality of childhood dream, that means we all have that to find for sure.
Right. It's not out there. It's here. It's in here. It's in each of us, in a sense. And I think you can engage with the trauma and abuse experience as a very awful thing that's happened to you. And yes, that's just true. And you can engage with that experience as a doorway into a transformative journey. And that's true too. The question is, what are you, what am I going to do? How are we going to respond to the fate that we've been given? It's personal. Because it's you and your life, me and my life, and it's impersonal because it's part of a human condition, the ugliness and the beauty of being embodied. I mean, Arlene, I can never pronounce her, Odegon, in her really fine book, The War Hotel, Psychological Dynamics in Violent Conflicts, says that we need three kinds of public awareness. And one is, this is relevant, to increase our knowledge of history and current events, and to do this knowing that we are sometimes treated as mushrooms, and that we're kept in the dark and we're fed BS, and you know what BS is. Just think about Iraq. For example, we're fed, you have to sort out the information from the misinformation, from the active disinformation. Think about what you read about Iraq in the mainstream press and listen to television, get some non-mainstream information or international information, you get a completely different picture. And think about, like, Hurricane Katrina. Who got what information when, and why didn't they? And the second kind of public awareness we need, Arlene says, is to understand international law and activity geared towards protection of human rights. For example, she gives a chilling example of journalists reporting on what was happening in Rwanda. They didn't know the difference between civil war and genocide. And you gotta be mindful of this when you're dealing with your clients. Like Judith Herman gives an example of the Holocaust, and a person says, "My family died in the Holocaust." No, your family was murdered in the Holocaust. And when people say to me things like, "Oh, your incestuous relationship with your father," I say, "No. Don't privilege it by calling it a relationship. It was a dynamic that I had no choice in." And the third, those kinds of things. Like, I read Jonathan Shea's wonderful book, Achilles in Vietnam, because I wanted to understand why so many men wandering around here, Portland, Oregon, so many homeless men who look and act really disturbed. And, like, why us, and I understand why so many of those men are combat veterans. They have been thrown on the scrap heap in a similar way to, in the sense of being ignored, and not reintegrated back into society in an active way, in a similar way to a lot of what happens in sexual abuse. A lot of the dynamics in that wonderful book are reflected also in many books about sexual abuse. Things like the betrayal of what's right. If you have command commanders in the army who send you in to fight and you don't have adequate protection, or you have outmoded fighting material, it's a suicide mission. You know, it's the same as a non-offending parent putting you in a room with someone they know is an offender. Okay. Yes, the second kind of public awareness is to understand international law and activity geared towards protection of human rights. Takes it away from just being personal. And the third kind of public awareness is about, and this is really important for us, our degree of freedom of thought and capacity to reflect rather than just adapt or react. Think about that in terms of, have you ever had a discussion with someone who is really supportive of the war in Iraq and you aren't, and suddenly you are unpatriotic? You know, it gets really polarized. And how we engage in communities tied to our relative privileges and worldviews, which we often don't question. I think one of the worst things about abuse and trauma are the people who deny its existence. To me, they're almost worse than the abusers. This incredible denial that it doesn't happen. And Howard Zinn says, how we think is not just mildly interesting or just a subject for intellectual debate, it's a matter of life and death. Particularly if you're dealing with people who had long-term abuse, they will sniff out inauthenticity like that. They've had to, as a matter of life and death. Arlene also says that public awareness is also a psychological and spiritual matter. What makes us respond and what makes us silent as individuals and collectivity? And collectively, what does make you respond to something, and what makes you turn off? It's a question to ask ourselves. I want to say a couple of things about things that have been really helpful to me. From process work, first of all, that we don't pathologize people's experience and slapping a label on a psychiatric label on someone is actually to freeze them in a process they're actually having. You actually impose a kind of state-oriented thinking. And on the other hand, sometimes a label helps a person to actually give a name to their experience. So you kind of have to find your way there. A label is just a label. And if you lose it, if you use it badly, then you use it badly. If you use it well, it can be helpful. Feedback, feedback, feedback. I want to recommend another book outside the process work list of books, and that is Louis Cozzolino's Neuroscience of Psychotherapy, Building and Rebuilding the Brain. It's really important to learn about how we remember things, because we have all kinds of different types of memory, and I really recommend that book. I'm not going to say a lot about it now because there's so much, and I think that you should read it. Sure. He's not a bad-looking bloke, actually. You did? Tana used to know him. She made a joke about having his phone number for those on the line there. Louis Cozzolino, C-O Z-O-L-I-N-O, and the neuroscience of psychotherapy. You have, there's a few different sorts of memories, and one is implicit, and that's the one that comes from that section of the brain that I couldn't pronounce. And most often in the early stages, a person will present with a whole lot of issues, but they can't put them together. There isn't a narrative thread that connects them yet. Particularly with things like flashbacks and traumatic dreams. And you, if you're working with children, which I once had the pleasure of doing, you watch some children, the way they play will give you a lot of indicators. Some children play just freely and others cannot. Why learn about neuroscience and psychotherapy? Why learn about the brain? Because the brain is not a fixed entity. It's a it changes. You can change the brain. You can change the way that you think and feel. You can certainly, in process work, we know the value of thinking about what we feel. And you have to, this implicit memory needs to be made explicit. You need to connect language to it. Many abuse survivors don't have language for their experiences. It comes in symbolic ways. It comes in visuals. It comes in flashbacks. It comes in body experiences. But it doesn't come in a cognitive language. That's more in the explicit memory. And it's much more complicated than that. And it would take at least 2 hours to do it justice. But I really recommend learning about how the brain functions, how it gets disordered through abuse and trauma, and how you can soothe that. And it's an exciting field. It cannot replace the one-to-one empathic relationship. Like you can take amino acids to help the brain fire. You can get a test to check your neurotransmitters, check the hormone levels. Some people think, oh my God, I'm going crazy. It may be that they're suffering from too much of this hormone and not enough of that hormone. Nutrition plays a very big part in this as well. And we're just beginning to learn about this. And is there anything that you want to ask me?
Comment or question?
It seems like what you're describing is the people who have experiential knowledge, but they don't have words or the story to go along with it, and that making that connection is really helpful. But there's some people also who could tell the story, but they're disconnected from the feeling.
Yes.
It's like the parts of their brain are compartmentalized. So just because somebody could tell a story doesn't mean that they've healed or integrated or whatever, become a thriver, that they can be disconnected from either the feeling or the body feeling, that parts of them are still left out. And that in some of my reading on trauma, it seems like connecting those parts of the body and the brain together and kind of tracking which parts are involved and which parts, if you said, where are you in your body right now? They'd be like, I have no clue. I left my body 20 minutes ago when I told the story, or because they could tell the story and they told the story maybe a lot in therapy or whatever, but they've left out pieces of themselves.
Right.
Do you have any, you said, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. That's really important because, and then you, the witness, the listener, will be dreamed up to feel a lot of things that the teller of the story, because she or he is leaving out all the emotions or the body, the somatic processes. I mean, you can be dreamed up to have all kinds of psychosomatic manifestations or emotional manifestations. It's true. Thank you for bringing that up. And that touches into one of the three clusters of symptoms that Judith Herman talks about. You know, I mentioned one of them, the hyper arousal, earlier on. And, you know, you're on red alert most of the time. You startle easily and you react irritably to very small provocations. The person has a major reaction to a minor thing. Consider the possibility that there's some abusive thing around. And a host of psychosomatic complaints. All my life I've had psychosomatic complaints, and now I tend to recognize them as early warning signs that there's some equilibrium distressed here. Another category of symptoms that she talks about is intrusion, where it's kind of like whether the trauma tape of your experience is sort of stuck in the play mode, in the repeat mode. And that's where you get sort of memory breaks in by flashbacks when you're awake, and traumatic dreams when you're asleep. And very small cues can evoke that. Even today, there's a particular song that I can't really bear to hear because it was played in the background while I was being raped. And I've come to see that it's by itself it's quite a nice song, but it's so embedded in the context for me that it's still freaky. And I have a panic attack when I hear it. And it's not as bad as it was. And it's still a pile of doo-doo to deal with. And the third category of symptoms is constriction. This is what you're talking about, where, you know, when you can't do anything externally, so you escape internally. Many women have talked about going into the wallpaper or going up ceiling and watching. It's kind of like an out-of-body experience. You alter your internal state of consciousness, and perceptions change. I think myself, when someone presents like that, I try to reframe it. You know, I support their primary process, I'm right there with them, with empathy, and I try to reframe it as an early attempt to make sense of a situation that you could not escape from. You know, there's something, this might seem weird to you, but there's something really smart about a psyche fracturing off into multiple bits in the face of overwhelming force in which you're rendered helpless, which is Judith Herman's definition of trauma. Overwhelming force in which you are rendered helpless. And some minds fracture off into multiple bits. I think that's quite creative. However, if these bits stay fractured off with no relationship between each one, person has lots of problems in life, and we need to do kind of group therapy with multiple personality. I've never worked directly with a client with multiple personality, but I once closely supervised someone who did, and she videoed all their sessions, and it was truly, this person completely changed their energy, their posture, their voice, their life history. It's like the whole thing got compartmentalized into digestible bits. I've met a lot of people who thought they were multiples, but actually they weren't. It's complicated. Ray is asking me, when I have a panic attack, when I hear that song, how do I work with it? It's happening to me, and I let it have its life. I can't, depending on where I am. If I can get out of there, I will. You bet. Why do I need this experience? I don't. And if I say it's on an airplane, which thank God it hasn't happened, well, I can go to the toilet. No, wherever I can go to get away from it, I will. But if I can't, then I soothe myself. It's like, in a way, many of us have had to grow up an internal parent, right? Had to develop an internal nurture of some sort. And part of that, a good parent, is also setting boundaries. And one of the boundaries that I do internally is to say, Emichi, this song is tweaking you back to something that happened then. It will go. It too will pass. And I just breathe. Sometimes that's all you can do. It's just to breathe through it and know that this hell is going to end. It's going to come to an end.
So you're saying that you inhabit the missing figure.
Mm-hmm. No one else is going to do it.
The one who wasn't there to take care of you.
Right.
Yeah. So you inhabit that. Okay.
You can't afford to rely. I mean, I'm speaking also from a place of like 30 years of work or more. You know, but so you have to put it in terms of a relative context. But before I do that, before I got to be able to do this, with my particular constitution of symptoms and experience, I would attack the source, get rid of it, or get out of there. I don't, it's like, I have schooled myself, hopefully not to freeze. You know, sometimes it happens, but I remember a time living alone in Sydney when my cat alerted me to the idea that someone was out the back door. I lived alone a number of years, and I trained myself to act first. And I'm one of the things about hyperarousal that works in my favor is that my reflex system is pretty fast. I'm pretty good in emergencies. The hard struggle is everyday life. You know, doing the regular things that you're doing. You put me in an emergency situation, I'm usually pretty good. After I have to deal with stuff. So I just know that about myself. I lost my thread. The cat, thank you. And I opened the door, grabbed the broom, and charged towards this really big shadow. This was an inner city in Sydney, standing there, and I got about as far as I am from you, Renata, 4 or 5 feet, and fortunately this very big shadow then bolted across the fence and disappeared. I collapsed. It was a real interesting thing. My knees just collapsed. And I'm going, help, help, in a little voice. I was completely gone. And it was like, you know. Then I went to, I called up some friends and asked them to come over. And that's something that some people, it's very hard to ask for help, and I'm one of them. So I'm in a constant learning. I just want to show off for a moment, because tonight I asked three friends to come here just to be in the audience. And that was, like, I think, very scary for me. And you know what? They all came. So, you know, the connection is huge. Empowerment and connection constantly. So when we make an abused person from any background an other, we do them a disservice. So knowing your own abuse history, knowing your own capacity to be abusive, knowing your own capacity to be a bystander without doing anything, being a human being in this realm is huge. Right, that thing about constriction, where you can't do anything externally, so you escape internally. That's when many people are numb, or they distort reality. And time is different. And many of us have left our bodies and watched it through other eyes. It was her that was being raped. And this is where some people can remain a bit indifferent and detached and profoundly passive, because there seems no point in struggling. And that's where we need to hold the person to the missing elements and say, wow, you, as you talk about that, I notice I'm having lots of feelings. And I'm wondering, I guess there's some use for you that you're not having the feelings right now. I guess you haven't had permission to, or, and there's lots of different ways you can approach it, but approach it directly. Sonia.
No, we're slowly running out of time, but I want to go back to something that you said earlier on, where you said don't do anything for your client that he can't do yet. What about modeling? Like, for example, in a situation like that, with somebody having no feelings, I might have a lot of feelings and would do it for them. What do you think about that?
It's complicated and situation specific. And that situation where if there's a persistent, repeated pattern of being split off from any affect, from any feeling, then I would model it. I would investigate it. But I wouldn't take up center stage too much. Model something with a purpose in mind. Share your own story with a specific intent to give an example of something. I had a bit of a problem some while back when I started talking to a male therapist about anal abuse, which I hadn't done before. And I have enough inner support to talk about that. And he got upset on behalf of all of men and felt really sorry and hurt and upset that this man had done this. And it wasn't helpful for me. It actually stopped me. I felt, oh, now I need to take care of him. And one of the ways to take care of him is to stop talking about this shit. It's too much for him. It would have been more helpful to me if he'd said, well, Nietzsche, in the moment, I'm not sure I can hear this. We had a sufficient enough relationship But to take it on, I want to say to male therapists, male helpers, don't take on the burden of all of mankind. Don't. You're one person here and now. If you take it on consciously as a role in a way that doesn't expect the client to take care of you in the sense of soothe you. Of course I do, but there was a point where I didn't. And the first time it happened, I took care and I said, thank you, and I really appreciate. The next time I says, I don't want you to be upset. And just waited. And having to deal with my little inner nation, you've been unkind, you know, because my socialized female kicks in, you know, caretake, take care of it all, you know. And I'm asked, what did I want? I wanted to be heard. I'd never spoken about that. I wanted to be heard and I wanted to be received. I didn't want to deal with the other side's upsetness. Right. Sonia was just saying that's the thing we become, where the therapist can become center stage and steal the show. I think it's important as a therapist, when you get to an edge, be real about it. It might not go along with your therapeutic persona. Be real about it. Because a therapist is only a human being. And you're there in, we're all there in service of the Tao, but in the moment, you know, there's another point. It's a delicate this, and I almost feel bad, I partly feel bad for saying it, because I've had to ask myself, did I shut that down because I've got wood to burn about men still? Maybe that's true, but I don't think in that particular moment that was what was really there. I also want to say to female therapists and helpers, don't be an endless, nurturing, perfect mother. You know, where you accept everything that comes along and just go, oh, you know, and soothe. There are times where you need to call someone on something. Like it's like, in a sense, getting caught in one state of what it means to be therapeutic. There have been a few female therapists that I've left because they're too nice. And if they're too nice, how can I bring out my unnice part? They in no way could they receive any of my abusive type energy. So where on earth am I going to make friends with it if the other side can't hold it or can't meet it? And some of the most unsavory energies are like the hungry ghosts. They want to be met. They want to be related to. Otherwise, they're left wandering around in dreamland and bugging us all in one way or another. They're ghosts and they impact us.
At some point in time, I'm wondering, in the situation of not doing what someone's capable of doing, you believe they're capable of doing, at some point in time, other than modeling, where does role play come in? It seems to me like it comes in, like, I don't want to call your dad and give him help, but can we practice that a bit? To see how you might do it. Would you comment on that?
I'm sorry, can you put that
down? Yeah, I'm just saying it occurs to me that role-playing with a client, when you come to this place where you feel like defending them, that you feel like, or you feel like doing something for them that you think they can't do for themselves, that you initiate some form of role-play.
I think that's a good way to approach it, if with the client's consent. It's a kind of, also it's kind of, this can be a moment to do some kind of process-oriented shamanism, where you go over the edge for someone, watching them. Let feedback be your guide, constantly. It's a good question. Right, this, I just want to finish one point about this constriction. You know, separating from your body and trying to recreate another way internally, it's a protective mechanism, and it needs to be understood as that. It's not that there isn't a sensitive human being under there, it's a protective mechanism. And that's a place in which many people will abuse substances because it perpetuates the numbness. But as we know from addiction work, after you've taken whatever substances, you come right back to the place, often with a whole other set of problems of guilt and internalized shame and this and that. And I think it's in Jonathan Shay's book where a combat veteran says that they identify this thing we're calling constriction. Then he said of himself that he had a 2,000-year-old stare. He had wide, hollow, anesthetized look of a man who no longer cares. And, you know, I think this... quite a few people walking around in our post-traumatic society like that. So, it isn't all out there. How are you doing out there on the telephone line? Do you want to say anything or ask anything?
Yeah, I do. This is Tamara.
Hi, Tamara.
Hi. I was curious if you have anything to say about the difference between working with like fresh trauma compared to, you know, long ago trauma.
Mm-hmm. For me, working with fresh trauma, the number one issue is safety. How, like, what that person needs in the immediate moment, and sometimes how they're going to make themselves, or how we can help make them safe when they leave here. One of the things that I used to do fairly regularly was make a suicide contract, which was that if the person really believes that they're going to kill themselves, that first they call me. Did you have a specific question?
No, I don't. I was just more thinking of, like, things I hear about in the news, hurricanes, and, you know, where you have maybe a lot of people, you know, all at once in a sort of traumatic state, and I'm just curious about mm-hmm. that as a different state than somebody who is, you know, functioning, thriving, but has trauma in their past.
Right. A lot of those groups, the way they approach it is about talking people through what they need to do now, rather than excavating the emotional impact issues. Because there isn't a safe context in doing that. I have a friend who's on a trauma line in Sydney, and I thought that she would do a whole lot of what I call recovery work. And she says, no, constantly what we're doing is contextualizing what's happened to the person and making, like, quick solution-based suggestions. Mm-hmm. Like, you're in a bank, you're a teller, you were robbed. This happened to you. It happened because of these reasons. It's different from being in a 24-hour, 3-hour, a 3-day situation of a tsunami, for example. Mm-hmm. And each situation has its particular dynamics that you have to deal with.
Yeah.
Does anyone else have anything to offer around that?
I did once a training with the Red Cross, and who go into emergency places like that. And what the term that they use is debriefing.
Oh, that's the word.
Right. Like just sitting with the people and talking, just listening, I guess.
Right. I don't think you can ever underestimate active listening.
Michi, Suzanne.
Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, thank you so much. And I know you mentioned when you were in talking that you would be hyper-vigilant and hyper-aware of danger that might be lurking, but there's also like trauma bonding where you go into situations where you repetitively harm yourself going towards something because there's some kind of mechanism working that you are blind or unconscious of bringing that same energy into your life that was abusive.
Right, right. Yes, constantly, well, in a soft way, not working in your best interest, or constantly re-traumatizing yourself, that's right. And before, it's like the protector is a missing element there, or the caregiver. And, I mean, remember how Arnie learned, first came upon the formation of the dream body? And he had, one of the early things that he'd noticed that people would have a symptom, and they'd amplify it, they'd exacerbate it, like they'd rub it if it was a painful spot.
Yeah.
As kind of an early attempt to make some sense of it. And it looks really destructive, and it's relative, of course, but in a way, I remember, I'll give you a personal example. Before I knew any better, I would constantly put myself in situations of social danger. I was constantly vicariously re-traumatizing myself, but an attempt to conquer being overcome by putting myself in danger deliberately and almost daring the worst to happen. And you could say on one level it's like a death wish, or another level, another place you could say, here's someone in an early attempt to work through a trauma event. And in my practice in Sydney, I had a bunch of women who were, at one stage, who were into S&M. And I'd say, what's the attraction? And I got the same answer, I'm in control. I get to go right to the edge, not the edge, well, it is the same, right to the edge. And then I get to decide whether we go forward or not. And the other person honors that. I never had that in my abuse. And, you know, for a time there, that flummoxed me. You know, I mean, I'm not here to judge other people's sexual practices, but I recognized it as an early attempt to try and get some control and some sovereignty over their experience. And at the same time, as a missing figure, with me as a young woman, putting myself in social situations of fairly dangerous. I go into a pub, I get rotten drunk, I go home with any man, and I'd have all kinds of dangerous sex and unprotected sex. This was, thank God, in the days before AIDS. And it's like, what was I doing? There's a missing element of self-care and protection. And have you seen that movie Looking for Mr. Goodbar? Similar to that. You know, there but for the grace go I. And I think it's a stage that you go through, and when you have a client who's doing that, you need to call them on it. You need to be as transparently concerned as you can. and ask them what the purpose is. There is a teleology, there's a meaning in it, in this crap, excuse me, in this terrible behavior. You have to find out what the goal is in that grind and bring it home strongly. How else can you get to know your own strength and your own power other than putting yourself in life-threatening situations? I took up boxing and judo. And that was at the suggestion of a therapist, and I was really good at it. You know, I had a lot of challenge, and it was a lot safer. But Sonia's asked me, did that curb my otherwise dangerous behavior? I'd like to say yes, and partly, but it was way more entrenched than that. I didn't have any sense of self, you know. I was acting out an early message I got, which was shut up and don't move, because nothing you ever do is going to turn out right, so why try? So, and picking up that before you can keep it out, and it was a kind of like, I call it a death wish. And then, basically, Sonia, it morphed into a drug addiction. And, you know, that's a long-term recovery process from that. And many people die. Many people die.
So what...
Hang on a sec. I think this gentleman here...
I just want to bring up I recognize the term repetition compulsion.
That's it. Thank you.
Okay. The other thing that comes up from...
Salt in the wound.
Going back. The other thing that comes up for me, especially for men, is in the realm of denial. That didn't hurt. That doesn't hurt. And I know men will, including myself, will repeat dangerous kinds of things just to show myself that didn't hurt. And it's a part of socialization bullshit.
Right, definitely is. And I think men get a really tough deal there. I would do things like, you know, I had a motorbike that I would drive really fast and really dangerously. I took drugs and danced all night, and I have huge gaps in my memory where I can't remember things. And, you know, those things come to an end also. You either die or you change, basically. I skied off a cliff, and Jane Ray asked me, how did I change? Part of it was I skied off a cliff and cracked a few vertebrae in my back and stopped. It made me stop. And actually, out of that experience, coming out of the hospital, I came out with a pretty strong desire for morphine. So, and nobody ever, ever gave me any education about this could happen. And that set up, you know, a whole bunch of years around pretty heavy drug addiction. And it wasn't until my first therapeutic relationship that the tide began to turn. And in my first therapy was was with a Presbyterian minister who, in a transactional analysis framework, actually reparented me. Can you imagine? I'd go to her office at one point. Here I am, a strong, stroppy dyke, right? Don't you with me. And I'm sitting curled up in her lap, and she's feeding me with a bottle. She reparented me. And then I started the process then of internalizing her, and my homework was to go home and fill up a baby bottle with half rosehip and half water and honey, and feed myself with a bottle, and I'm in my bed with my hot water bottle and my cats, and, you know, giving myself something that was absent. That was, you know, some decades ago, and it's not as dramatic or as huge now, but it's why I say self-soothe when I have panic attacks.
Been a quandary for me. It brings back this issue of I'll say what the quandary is it brings back this issue between being a rescuer and infantilizing or patronizing somebody by providing, you know, like you said, being the mother, the great mother, the great father, the whatever. And it was only was talking about modeling it or reparenting, where sometimes it seems what is called for is being that parent, so that the person can internalize something that they never got.
Right.
And at the same time, am I doing something that really is doing something they need to do, which is disempowering or, you know, making them or keeping them an infant or. So knowing the difference, and it's difficult sometimes between knowing, and I'm wondering how you, what you've learned about that, or how you, in your work with people who've been abused in that.
It is difficult. It is difficult. And it's like, it helps to have some kind of overall sense of the journey. That's why I think Judith Herman's map can be useful, right? Or a sense of where the position, where the person is at in terms of like where they'd like to be and where they are, if they have even a sense of the future. But if they don't, you can use the kind of perceptual map like this, and then I'm feeling a little bad about what I said earlier, but there definitely are times when you need to intervene in a parental fashion. There are times when you're an educator. There are times when you're a hand holder. There are times when you are the good enough breast. There are times when you are the parent that sets limits. There are times when you are like a kind of spiritual healer. And there are times when you're a friend and in the session. And I guess my rule of thumb is, if you think something is needed, try it. Watch the feedback, and try it a few times. And then, if you get negative feedback three times, it's not right. I don't really have. A good answer to that. Right. No. Robert was talking about, it seemed an important experience, me sitting on the lap of this therapist and being reparented. And it was Robert. She recognized at that point that I was a very fractured, fragmented human being, and that there was no self-care anywhere. I was living in the country in a dump. You know, I had no hot water. I had just had electricity. It was freezing cold. I had virtually no income, and no sense of the future, and fairly isolated because there was no connection basically with the social fabric. And so, and her analysis of, you know, the child, the parent. And what's the other one?
Adult.
And the adult. You see, that one was missing. the child was there, and the pseudo-adult, which was basically, don't you mess with me, I'll wipe the floor with you, no, which isn't the authentic me, but no parental energy whatsoever. See, it's making me breathless. And so she, you could say, looking at it in process terms, she embodied a figure that was totally absent. And it was right on.
I was just going to say that it connected what you said a while back. The first thing is safety.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you have no food, hardly an income, you're in a dump, I mean, it's like sort of taking care of the basic safety.
Taking care of the basics, right.
Right. It sounds that was the very beginning of the journey.
It was the very beginning
of the journey. And it was appropriate. what somehow that was appropriate for you.
Mm-hmm.
And what you described earlier in your talk was at a different stage of your journey where you felt somehow that kind of doing it for you was no longer appropriate.
Thank you, Ryan. That's a really, that is just accurate. So in a way, it's like, yes, you can't, that statement has to be taken not out of the blue, but in a context, because the kind of support that I need now is witness when I go and when I start to talk about things that I've never talked about. And other than that, I need support with some of the long-standing edges, which is to put my best foot forward in those two areas I mentioned earlier. I'm being asked, do I want to say anything else? And I want to ask if the people on the phone have any questions or comments before we begin to close up.
Thank you from me.
Thank you, Suzette.
Yes, and also from me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Tamara. You okay with us?
Yeah, I'm still here, and I'm still doing a lot of thinking about it. It was for me a very thought-provoking thing about self-destructive behavior coming perhaps from a place of at least having a sense of having control over what is happening to one. So that was really quite an exciting idea for me. I'm doing a lot of thinking about
mm-hmm.
that. It's great. But the whole talk was wonderful, Michi. Thank you.
Thanks. Well, that reminds me, Phyllis, you just sparked something in me. In Amy's wonderful book, Alternative Therapy, she talks about us having two goals in process work. And one is, you know, awareness, the constant support and development of awareness. And the second one is integration, like integrating new behaviors into our lives. Because you know how it is sometimes, you know what you should be doing, but you aren't actually doing it. I think that's a human thing.
I have that from time to time.
Right. So it's like, yes, we can have awareness, but we need to weave it into the fabric of our everyday lives in consensus reality. And, yes.
Michi, I just would like to say how much I appreciate your journey, your life journey, and that your courage to share it with us and to have worked so hard.
Thank you. And, you know, thank you very much. And I feel I have this childhood dream that's extremely helpful to me. And can I just take a moment and tell you it? My childhood dream, as I have a bunch of memories, but my childhood dream is me with a huge paintbrush, roller, and a dirty wall full of all kinds of gunk and this and that, and I'm whitewashing it. And over time, it's taken on different meanings. From first, oh, I'm just here to clean up the shit, to now, it's like, okay, part of my journey in this incarnation is to create a fresh slate, a fresh canvas, so to speak, upon which to create something, a constant recreation of myself, I guess. That's something to do with a life, right? Oh, yes, that too.
Said, and also teaching that.
Thank you. Did you want to say something, Nick?
Now, because I guess we come to the end of the time, and I...
the thing I was going to say doesn't really matter, because I just feel so grateful to you and really want to honor your incredible journey and you as a person and as a teacher. And thank you so much for being with us tonight and sharing so much of what you have. It's like, this is kind of like an ideal of research for me, that it comes from such lived experience as well as so much intelligent thought about something and so much study on so many levels. And I know you've done that, so I want to thank you deeply for being here tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much. We're all clapping and yelling for Amici.
Thank you. And I am one of many. Okay, just receive, Amici. Just receive it. Thank you and good night.
Bye. Bye.